Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Consolidated Freightways Corporation against Castle. I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. There is only one issue which is properly before this Court, and that is the issue of whether or not the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, in denying attorney's fees under 1988, should have given reasons for its denial. The facts and procedural posture of this case are this. In 1978, Consolidated Freightways brought suit against a number of officials of the state of Iowa, alleging that Iowa's statute and the enforcement of it, which bans 65-foot twin trailers in Iowa, was unconstitutional. The complaint alleged that the actions of the Iowa officials in enforcing that statute were a violation of 42 U.S.C. 1983, but no damages were requested. The complaint did, however, request attorney's fees under 42 U.S.C. 1988. The district court bifurcated the trial and took the case in chief, putting aside the question of attorney's fees. The district court found for Consolidated Freightways on the case in chief. The result was appealed to the Eighth Circuit. The Eighth Circuit affirmed. In return, it was brought before this court, and this court affirmed also.
But you're asking for your attorney's fees in the Eighth Circuit.
That is correct. At the conclusion of the appeal in the Eighth Circuit, pursuant to the Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure, the clerk of the Eighth Circuit sent a letter directing Consolidated Freightways to file a bill of cost, itemizing therein all costs which they desired to have awarded to them and warning of waiver if they did not provide all cost. 42 U.S.C. 1988 provides for the award of attorney's fees as cost. To avoid waiver, we filed a bill of cost with the Eighth Circuit that laid out as a separate item attorney's fees under 1988, and we filed with the bill of cost a letter to the Eighth Circuit informing them that the case below had been bifurcated and suggesting that remand to the district court would certainly serve judicial economy. There was no briefing of the issue of attorney's fees. The Iowa officials filed in response, as is provided for in the rule, a simple statement that they were in opposition, citing no law or no way constituting a brief. The Eighth Circuit chose not to remand to the district court nor to request briefs. Instead, it denied attorney's fees, and the substance of their decision is simply one line stating that the motion for attorney's fees is denied.
And you say they do not have the discretion to do that?
We say that they do not have the discretion to deny attorney's fees without stating the reason for the denial. That's correct. Immediately after the denial, Consolidated Freightways filed a motion to vacate, requesting either an opportunity to brief the issue or the alternative that the Eighth Circuit vacate its order denying attorney's fees and remand the case to the district court. Very short summary briefs supporting that motion were filed, but no extensive briefs were filed on the issue of attorney's fees. The Eighth Circuit chose not to vacate its order, denied the motion to vacate.
And on how many different grounds do you suppose they might have rested their denial?
Your Honor, I guess I don't really know a number. There are three that perhaps seem most likely to me in our brief.
Well, that's a number.
We went through an itemized 10.
That's a number. That's three.
Well, I don't pretend to understand
which ones do you think they might have rested the denial?
I think they might have rested it on the 11th Amendment, although I think there's law to the opposite in that case. I think they may have rested it on the argument that 1983 does not particularly cover this situation. I think they may have, in fact, intended in an oblique way to simply send the matter, have the district court decide it initially.
Well, and rather than remand, could they have rested on any ground that, 1988 applies, but as a matter of discretion, we're not going to allow.
Yes, they could have. They could have rested it on the ground that 1988 applies, but that there were special circumstances in this case that would have prevented an award of attorney's fees.
What was the argument made by the other side in support of the judgment below?
Iowa,
before that court.
no argument was made prior to the Eighth Circuit's decision.
To the Eighth Circuit at all?
No argument was made to the Eighth Circuit at all.
Not even briefed?
No briefs. The appendix contains the sum and substance. It was a bill of cost, simply itemizing the cost, and a simple statement from Iowa that they were opposed to the allowance of cost.
Not saying on what grounds?
Not saying on what grounds. There were briefs filed in the Eighth Circuit on the motion to vacate.
Yes.
After the Eighth Circuit had already rendered its decision, but there were no briefs filed before the initial decision.
And what was the position taken by Iowa on the motion to vacate?
Iowa opposed the motion to vacate.
On what grounds?
On the grounds that 1983 did not apply, and if I recall correctly, on the grounds that I'm not sure whether they raised the 11th Amendment grounds in their brief
or
not.
Did you meet those grounds of objection at all?
No, we.
In briefing before the
No. We filed a simple brief supporting the motion to vacate. They filed a brief opposing the motion to vacate, and the Eighth Circuit decided on those two briefs.
Well, what I'm trying to get at, what issues did you, on what grounds did you oppose the motion to vacate?
Did I oppose the motion?
I supported it.
We supported it on the grounds that 42 U.S.C. 1988 was applicable. And that no special circumstances existed here.
And did you address the 1983 question?
We did very summarily, yes. I should make it clear, the brief was intended as a brief to support the motion to vacate.
Yes.
The motion to vacate requested that the Eighth Circuit, if it desired to decide this issue itself, set up a briefing schedule, permit us to file briefs and affidavits on it. It was not a brief on the issue of whether or not attorney's fees should be awarded. It did cover that issue to the extent of trying to point out to the Eighth Circuit this is a real issue and not something.
Did the motion request the Eighth Circuit to state the grounds of its denial?
Yes, it did.
But you must have taken the position that 1983 covered this action.
Yes, we did.
And that under 1988, the Court of Appeals or the District Court did not possess sufficient discretion to deny your motion for your bill of costs, even though it was covered by your substantive action was covered by 1983.
That's correct, Your Honor. We certainly took the position consistently throughout that 1983 applied and that attorney's fees were due us under 42 U.S.C. 1988. The difficulty...
Was your action originally brought in the district court as a 1983 action?
Yes, Your Honor. The complaint, as one of the causes of action, alleged 1983 and specifically asked for attorney's fees.
Do you think under the statute the problem would have been satisfied if the court simply recited in the exercise of our discretion, fees are denied? Or do they have to say A, B, C, D...
No, I should make clear,
discretion.
I don't think that courts necessarily have to write erudite opinions on each matter that comes before them. All that was necessary here could have been disposed of in one or two sentences.
What about the one sentence I just gave you? In the exercise of our discretion, fees are denied.
That would have been a closer question, but yes, I think that would have been adequate. It would have at least provided the parties the idea that what the problem was here was a factual problem, that it was the court exercising its discretion and not making a legal decision that 1983 doesn't apply. The reason why I think some statement of reasoning is required by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals is perhaps well illustrated by this case. The common practice in most circuit court of appeals for attorney's fees on the appeal is to have that decided by the district court. And it's the practice that this court originally encouraged in antitrust cases, Perkins v. Standard Oil, and has been followed fairly consistently by all of the circuits, though I think all of the circuits recognize that they have the power to decide attorney's fees themselves. The Eighth Circuit has not been consistent with the other circuits. It frequently decides attorney's fees itself, setting both the amount of the fees and making the initial decision as to whether or not fees should be granted. That makes this court the initial court of review. There is no other court to which an appeal can be taken.
Well, then does that not demonstrate that they acknowledge that it's a discretionary matter? The practice you've just described, doesn't that suggest that they acknowledge that they had the legal authority under 1988, but
Well, I think
as a matter of discretion, they were not going to give the fees.
That's right. That is difficult to square with the statute. The statute provides for an award of fees, and under this court's interpretation and other courts' interpretations.
But you just told me that if they'd recited in the exercise of discretion, right. The court hereby denies.
If the court exercised discretion, then under the interpretation of the statute, they would have found special circumstances. And I think a statement that they exercised discretion logically means that they found special circumstances, which are the instances in which the statute permits attorney's fees not to be awarded, and that would have been enough of a guidance to both this court and to us as attorneys so that we could have at least determined what the issue was on appeal.
Well, but aren't you saying, in effect, that you're willing to lose this case, but you just want the Eighth Circuit to write a couple more sentences?
Well, the difficulty is, I don't know that I'd say that I'm willing to lose this case, but what the issue here is, as I see it, is we need to know why it was denied so that we can determine, is this an issue that should be appealed? Is this an issue where the Eighth Circuit was wrong? Perhaps the Eighth Circuit's right. And on reflection and reviewing the opinion, we may conclude that, yes, we lost and we lost fairly. The difficulty with this court standing as the only court of appeal, the initial court of review, this court has to pick and choose what cases it's going to hear. And for it to pick and choose what cases it's going to hear, it has to look at petitions for certiorari.
Let me try.
We can't determine.
What specifically can you point to me to which says that a court has to give reasons?
Almost uniformly, every circuit court in reviewing district court decisions on attorney's fees has laid down as an absolute rule
what
that
rule
the district
is
court
it that requires this court here involved,
this court
the
has,
Eighth Circuit, to do it.
This court has previously, in a closely analogous case, North Cross versus Memphis Board of Education, reversed the Sixth Circuit and remanded to it on the grounds that the Sixth Circuit had failed to give reasons
for
denying attorney's fees. It was not 1988, it was the Emergency School Aid Act, but they're very closely analogous statutes. The Sixth Circuit had failed to give reasons.
That was a 1983 case, wasn't it? If it involved a school, it must have
been. It was involved a school. I'm not sure if 1983 or if there may have been other statutory bases, but the statute awarding attorney's fees in that case or providing for the award of attorney's fees.
But do you agree that 1988 provides for attorney's fees only in 1983 cases?
Yes.
You agree with that?
There are some minor other statutes, yes.
You agree with that? And your case involves only 1983.
That's correct. Our case involves only.
I thought you said it involved several questions.
Well, no. There are underlying. I think that the only issue properly before this court is whether the Eighth Circuit should have given a statement of reasons.
Well, why?
There are, because without a statement of reasons, it is impossible for this court to adequately review what the Eighth Circuit did.
Do you know how many cases come from New York where no opinions are written at all and this court decides them?
Yes, but at least.
Do you know? Quite a few.
But at least
do you think we have to have an opinion in every case in order to decide it?
I think that it is important to have an opinion in a case.
I didn't
case.
Say important. I said necessary. That we can't rule without it.
Certainly you can rule without it. This court certainly has the power to do so.
Repeat. So why do we have to do it in this?
What I am
what
suggesting.
What makes this one so special?
Well, I think what makes it so special, in part, is that you're dealing with a federal court, and in part, one of the powers that this court has is supervisory powers over the federal courts. This court properly should determine how it wants cases presented to it.
What about the Fifth Circuit's rule, where they simply affirm by order on the merits, not on costs, without any opinion or any explanation of reason?
You can perhaps justify no opinion where you have a district court opinion below. And the typical abbreviated opinion that I've seen, for the reasons stated below, we affirm. You can, and the Eighth Circuit even has a rule providing for the disposal of frivolous cases that merely says we reverse, or pardon me, we affirm and cites the rule, that at least tells the attorney on what basis his case was decided. Here we have no way of determining what the basis was for the decision.
Since you have just told us, counsel, that the Eighth Circuit practice is recognizes that it's a discretionary power, and sometimes they allow and sometimes they do not allow fees, and you have also said, I think in precisely these words, that it would have satisfied the statute if they had recited, in the exercise of our discretion, the application for fees is denied. Now, doesn't the word deny embrace that just as a denial of cert up here?
No, Your Honor, perhaps...
The states, when we deny cert, we don't explain it. We deny, and I think it is accepted that that's in exercise of our discretion.
I perhaps put too much emphasis on the words in the exercise of our discretion because I immediately put that in the framework of the statute. The statute, as interpreted, requires an award of attorney's fees unless some very narrow factual circumstances exist. So if the court says in the exercise of our discretion we deny attorney's fees, that means they've gotten past the legal question of whether or not the statute applies. And as soon as they say we're exercising discretion, you immediately know this must be the reason why they're denying. So in this particular circumstance, exercise of discretion, because the discretion is so narrow as to the award, granted very large as to the amount of the award, but very narrow as to whether or not you do award, it tells you what the court's doing. As a general proposition.
I thought I heard you answer my brother Marshall that if you have no 1983 cause of action, then you have no claim under 1988 for attorney fees. Is that right?
That's correct. In this case, that is correct.
May we not then see what you pleaded in the way of cause of action? And if we hold there was no 1983 cause of action pleaded, can't we affirm without more?
This court certainly can. It has the power
to do
so.
Is there any reason we shouldn't?
Yes. I think the reason that you shouldn't comes precisely to the point that I was making before. What you should do is establish by what procedure do you want these cases to come before you. If you want circuit courts to decide attorney's fees initially and do so without an opinion, you are going to be continually presented as the only available court of review with petitions for certiorari that are unable to tell you what the issues are. They will be unable to tell you why the lower court decided. They will be unable to tell you what was wrong with the lower court's decision. You will, in effect, be presented again and again with de novo cases, starting out with, we need to prove these things in order to be entitled to attorney's fees, and we think we've proven them all, and go through, and the parties can argue about each one of the things that need to be proven and every issue under the sun. The point is, if you want to establish a procedure, it is desirable to have the Circuit Court of Appeals state its reasons so that this court can properly exercise its appellate review authority, be able to look at the petition for certiorari and determine whether this is a case that it should hear or a case that lacks importance to be heard.
You think 1983 embraces the inverse side of the Commerce Clause?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. I perhaps should frame it a little bit more clearly. I think that there is a right to engage in interstate commerce. And I think that that is a fundamental right. I think it was recognized as a fundamental right at the time of the Constitution, and that the Constitution secures that right by putting a provision in it, providing, in effect, at least to some degree, exclusive jurisdiction in Congress to regulate interstate commerce because the drafters recognized that state regulation was inimical to the right to engage in interstate commerce.
But Cooley against Board of Wardens, before the Civil War, established that Congress's right to regulate interstate commerce was not exclusive.
This court has always held that there are some areas where Congress can regulate, or some sets of circumstances where Congress can regulate, but the states cannot. Now, what the definition is of what the states cannot regulate has changed through the 200 years, but there's always been areas where the states can't regulate because they impose an unconstitutional burden, or perhaps because it's direct, indirect regulation, depending upon which Commerce Clause test you use. But there's always been held to be an area that is exempt from state regulation. And that's precisely what the drafters intended. The reason the Constitutional Convention was called was because of state regulation of interstate commerce and the destruction of interstate commerce it was causing. That was the original reason.
And the answer that the framers gave was to give Congress the power to regulate interstate commerce.
That's correct.
It did not, certainly in hic verba, say that the states were divested of their authority to regulate interstate commerce, only that if Congress superseded state regulation by congressional action,
Perhaps as an example, this court itself in Consolidated Freightways v. Castle, Castle v. Consolidated Freightways, the case in chief, held that even though Congress had not acted on the regulation of truck length, there was an area where the state could not act.
Well, I said that. That's why I said the framers in hic verba did not say that.
That's right.
This court has developed the...
That's right. I think the framers certainly intended it, though. There was no... great outcry that this court was broadening the Constitution or unreasonably interpreting it because, as I say, part of the reason for the initial Constitutional Convention was the recognition that the state regulation was causing problems, and part of the reason for granting the power to Congress was to remove it from the states.
You certainly find several instances of this court referring to the right to engage in interstate commerce free from the wrong kind of state regulation.
That's correct. The original Gibbons v. Ogden, Justice Marshall referred to a right to engage in interstate commerce as a natural right of man. This court, in its Commerce Clause cases, has frequently spoken of a right to be free of improper state regulation. Now, what constitutes improper state regulation, I think, is, you know, in any given case can be debated, but that there is an area where the Constitution, by its own words, removes from the states the power to regulate, whether it be for improper regulation or only certain subject matter or whatever, there is an area that is removed from state regulation. That's the protection, the securing of the right to engage in interstate commerce that we think was violated by Iowa. We had a right to engage in interstate commerce, repeatedly recognized by this court, recognized as a natural and inalienable right. It was secured by the Constitution because one of the purposes of the Commerce Clause was to remove from the state the power to regulate interstate commerce in certain instances, and this was one of those instances. The right was violated. Consequently, 1983 was violated.
Would you agree that if the court did not agree with that analysis, felt that this really was not a 1983 case and therefore 1988 was not intended to authorize the award of fees in this case, then there would be no duty in the Court of Appeals to give you a statement of reasons? If the law is you're not entitled to fees, why do they have to give you a statement of reasons?
No, if what you're saying is the Court of Appeals may have decided.
But that may be the law. Maybe we think Congress did not intend to authorize fees here. Don't you have to persuade us that Congress authorized fees before there would be any duty at all on the Court of Appeals to give a statement of reason?
Well, I think it would at least have to state the reason of you haven't persuaded us.
Well, supposing we had a case last year in which we said 1988 doesn't apply to a case like this. Then your fee request was presented to the Court of Appeals. Couldn't they simply deny it without an opinion?
I think they could deny it because frivolous, and that's a simple...
But would they have to say it's frivolous when it would be obvious that it was?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, you just agreed before that if they said denied in exercise of discretion, it would be enough.
Denied in exercise of discretion, I think, would be enough because it says... In this context...
If you get over the first hump that Justice Brennan and Justice Stevens have been talking to you about, the first hump, the 1983 hump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it's denied in discretion, then obviously we got over the 1983 hump.
I'm not suggesting discretion. I'm suggesting the statute said in so many words, no fee shall be allowed in Commerce Clause litigation. Would they still have to give you a statement of reasons?
No.
I think they could do what was their practice and simply say denied Rule 19, which means it's denied
because of
privilege.
They couldn't do what they did here.
But, yes, they need to give reasons.
Supposing you'd ask them not for fees, but supposing you'd ask them for a $400 million judgment on the theory that you don't like your opponent. and they just said denied, would they have to give you a statement of reasons?
Yes. You say they have to give me a statement of reasons. I'm not so concerned, and I'm not resting my case on my need for a statement of reasons.
Pardon me? You say we need it.
You need it. That's correct. That's precisely correct. And you need it particularly, whereas here the Eighth Circuit's acting as that initial court, acting as trial court.
Why do we need it if we think the law, in effect, says you don't get fees in a case like this?
Well, that's perhaps begging the question.
Well, it seems to me you've got the burden of convincing us that there's an authorization for fees before you can persuade me, at least, there's any reason to give us a statement for denial. If the law doesn't authorize fees, I don't care what reason, whether the Court of Appeals gives the reasons or not.
That's right. But the point, perhaps, is if the law doesn't authorize, then no, you don't need to care what reason the Eighth Circuit did, because that's sort of an initial foreclosing question, just as if you concluded that there were no jurisdiction.
And I suggest you're the party who's asking for the fees, so it seems to me you have the burden of demonstrating that the statute authorizes fees for you.
Well, that may be correct, but you can think of a number of additional factors and additional issues that could foreclose the question. And we very quickly would be back to the original situation of here are 10 issues which may have been determinative. We need to argue all 10 to persuade you that we should be awarded fees. That, you know, that may be the case, but it's not a very comfortable way of handling cases. And I suggest one that is going to make this court's task of review a very difficult task.
Do I understand you correctly that if we say the court has to give you reasons and we send it back saying that, and the court says our reason is we have exercised our discretion, that's the end? Is that your position?
Under the peculiar terms of this
is
statute.
Is that your position?
Yes, sir.
Well, what are we doing?
Under the peculiar terms.
What are we sitting here for? Why don't we just do it that way?
Under the peculiar terms of this statute, if you say, under the exercise of our discretion, you have immediately told everyone concerned what the reason is. It's because the statute, as interpreted, means you've got to award attorney's fees unless A exists.
What reason, if a court just doesn't do something, is it's within their discretion not to do it? Isn't that automatic?
No, Your Honor.
Well, you want the court to say we don't grant you tax because we don't like it?
There are certain statutes that give very limited discretionary powers to the court. There are certain things that courts must do. 1988 is very close to being one of those statutes because...
Well, is it?
Pardon me?
You say close to, is it?
It is not in one circumstance.
Well, if it's not,
that is,
then
the court need not
there?
Award attorney's fees if it finds special circumstances. Special circumstances are very narrowly defined. If the court says we're not awarding in our discretion, they are saying we found the special circumstance that the statute speaks of. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Solicitor General.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals held below that Consolidated Freightways was not entitled to attorney's fees for the appeal part of the litigation in the case in chief with which this court is previously familiar.
Was that, Mr. Chance, for the appeal part in that court or also here?
Only in the Eighth Circuit. And it was the bill of costs in question was filed before the case came up here. Iowa has consistently taken the position that Dormant Commerce Clause case litigation is not within 1983. We took that position in our answer. We took that position with counsel, as the letter to the clerk to which he referred makes clear. We had indicated that we were going to oppose any award of fees. We resisted the bill of cost, indicating that we objected to any award of fees. When they moved to vacate, we made very explicit that it was our contention that 1983 was not applicable. And in our brief in resistance to the motion to vacate, we developed, admittedly in skeletal form, the contention which is developed in our brief, namely that Commerce Clause cases involve the allocation of governmental power and do not secure individual rights. So we believe that issue was clearly presented to the court below, and we believe, we think it's clearly implicit in the course of the proceeding that that was the basis for the Eighth Circuit's action. But even if it is not, we think it's clear that this court may and would need to, if it addressed the may affirm on the ground that we presented below, namely that it was not a 1983 case.
This is on the ground that you may defend your judgment in your favor on any ground that you raise below.
Exactly. The rule of Langness versus Green and Dandridge versus Williams and so on. Congress, the general rule, of course, is that American rule is that fee shifting is not permitted. Congress has authorized fee shifting in certain civil rights statutes. Under 42 United States Code, Section 1988. The only such statute invoked here is 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. And thus the question becomes whether Section 1983 provides a remedy for dormant commerce clause cases. Section 1983 provides a remedy in the language of the statute when there has been a deprivation of a right, privilege, or immunity secured by the Constitution. And the particular question before this court then is whether that language should be construed to reach commerce clause cases. Iowa's contention that 1983 does not reach dormant Commerce Clause litigation can usually be divided into two propositions. The first is that the reach of Section 1983 is not coextensive with the Constitution. Not every lawsuit in which a constitutional claim is asserted against a state or a state official involves a deprivation of any rights, privileges, or immunities secured by the Constitution. And the second proposition is that the minor premise, if you will, is that the Commerce Clause should be understood as a provision allocating authority, structuring governmental power, and not as a provision securing rights against government. I think the first proposition, the proposition that the reach of 1983 is not coextensive with the Constitution, must be regarded as well established. In Chapman versus Houston Welfare Rights Organization, this court held, and with, I believe, without dissent on this point, that litigation against state officials, which invokes the Supremacy Clause, without more, cannot be brought pursuant to 28 U.S.C. Section 1343.3. Now, in the language of 1343.3 is completely identical to the language of 1983 as it relates to the Constitution.
It certainly didn't say there that because you can't bring it under 1943, you can't bring it under 1331 either.
If I understand your question, we would certainly concede that this case can be brought under 1331.
Well, in 1983, too.
Well, 1983
just among other things, it removed the amount in controversy.
That's correct.
But that's all been done away with now anyway.
That's correct. An operational consequence, Justice White, I think the only thing at stake here is whether or not attorney's fees are to be awarded in Commerce Clause cases.
And if we were to conclude that 1983 doesn't reach it, that would be the end of the case, wouldn't it?
Exactly right.
Or even if we concluded that 1983 did reach it, it would be the end of the case if we thought that it was presumptively an exercise of discretion, of an unexplained denial.
This court certainly could affirm on that ground.
Well, you don't want us to reverse if we disagree with you on 1983.
Certainly not. Certainly not.
Well, Shantz, let me go back to your reference to Chapman. And that held, as I recall, that the jurisdictional statute, 1343, is not as broad in its coverage as 1983.
That's correct.
Now, how is that support for the proposition that 1983 doesn't reach this claim?
1343 speaks in terms of rights secured by the Constitution.
And that does not include supremacy clause rights.
Right. And from then on, 1343, when it refers to laws, refers to civil rights laws. Discuss what this court held in Houston welfare laws. But with respect to the Constitution, rights secured by the Constitution, the language is identical. And in Lynch versus Household Finance, this court said clearly that with respect to constitutional rights, the reach of 1343, the reach of 1983 are the same.
Right. And so if this is, but how does that answer the question whether there is a right to engage in interstate commerce, or that's a way of phrasing it, or whether 1983 was the cause of action statute in this case?
One of the arguments advanced in Chapman was that this was a case involving rights secured by the Constitution,
right,
because it was a case premised on the supremacy clause,
right,
a constitutional provision.
Correct.
And this court rejected that, I believe, unanimously, saying that language, rights secured by the Constitution, doesn't include every Constitution.
Did not include the supremacy clause. Rather, that was in the nature of a statutory claim rather than a constitutional claim, based on a violation of a federal statute. But here there's a violation. There's alleged, and I guess we held in the case was here before, that there was a violation of a constitutional provision.
We certainly don't mean to contend that Chapman literally controls because it does not reach the second proposition. But we think it is square authority for the major premise, which is that 1983 is not coextensive with the Constitution. Not
at least,
every
at least to the extent that it rejects the claim that the Supremacy Clause is a constitutional claim. But I don't really see that it sheds light one way or the other on the question whether a Commerce Clause claim is a constitutional claim.
Well,
see, in that case, there were two ways to characterize the claim, one as a violation of a federal statute or as a violation of a federal statute and hence also a violation of the Constitution. And we said, well, really, that was a statutory claim. But here you have no basis other than the constitutional provision itself, so it seems to me it's quite different.
Well, the Supremacy Clause is a relational clause rather than a grant of substantive power, and I won't concede that I won't press the analogy to the end. I think we have something more to establish, if you will. But I understood Petitioner to argue in his brief, essentially, that any constitutional claim doesn't have to involve rights, can be brought within 1983. And we believe that a Supremacy Clause case is in a sense, a constitutional claim, not necessarily in the same sense as is involved here.
You would say that your opponent did not have a right to drive these big, long trucks over your highways without complying with your truck length regulations. That's not a right in your view.
That's not a right, as that term has been employed in was employed under 1983. Just to add one more point on the first point. In drafting 1983, the 42nd Congress did not employ the language of Article 3, cases arising under the Constitution. Only 4 years later, when they passed the predecessor to Section 1331, they did use the language arising under. We don't believe that's an accident. We do not think that was a general federal question jurisdiction for all actions against where the defendant is the state or the state official. And we think Chapman, at least with respect to the major premise, is important support for that.
Mr. Schantz, take the Equal Footing Clause of the Constitution that talks about new states being admitted only on equal footing with all the original states. Do you think 1983 would cover a private action seeking to enforce the Equal Footing Clause as against a state?
I think there could be some standing questions as well, and I'm perhaps more prepared to address some other provisions of the Constitution. Article 1, Section 10 contains some other limitations on the state. They're not supposed to coin money. They're not supposed to make treaties. not supposed to impose export duties for raising revenue purposes, at least. Now, it's difficult to articulate the notion that, that kind of a provision confers an individual right. We have what we have in Article 1, Section 8 and Article 1, Section 10 are clauses that say this belongs to the federal government, this belongs to the states. And this court has properly assumed the role of refereeing in the ambiguities among those clauses, of which the ambiguities in the Commerce Clause, of course, are substantial. If I may move to the second proposition and elaborate further on the claim that the Commerce Clause does not guarantee rights, we do not mean to demean the importance of the Commerce Clause. Obviously, it's been of enormous significance politically in terms of shaping this country into a nation. It's been enormous importance economically in terms of establishing a free trade unit. But those are general benefits to the public as a whole. They are not of the stuff of which individual rights against government concern themselves. Provisions involving individual rights typically are of a different character. They rest upon principles of political theory about the proper relationship between the state and the individual generally, principles of moral philosophy. And to be sure, they include property rights as well as personal rights. We in no way are, as petitioner suggests, asking any reconsideration of Lynch versus Household Finance.
May I just interrupt again? You're not contending it's limited to 14th Amendment claims, discrimination claims.
Oh, absolutely not.
So you would agree it would include First Amendment claims?
We would agree that it includes claims that is for which it is difficult to find an express textual ground, like the freedom of association, the right to privacy, the right to personal mobility.
Under your test, what about the right to, say, object to state subsidy of a religious school or something like that, an Establishment Clause claim? Under your test, how would you decide that?
I think it's clearly established that the Establishment Clause has an individual rights aspect to it, that the standing question which this Court wrestled with in Flass v. Cohen, I think, sharpens that and suggests that that would be a hard case, but I think it's a hard case that's already been decided in favor of including establishment cases, treating them as rights.
So you would say that 1988 would apply to that kind of a claim under the test you're proposing?
Absolutely. It certainly includes all of the Bill of Rights and everything that's brought in some way or another under the umbrella of substantive due process, privileges, immunity.
You need to go that far for this case. Just to send things
that affect us. All this Court needs to say in this case is that dormant Commerce Clause cases do not involve rights within the meaning of 1983.
Where are you going to end up?
Is there any aspect, Mr. Chance, of laws involved here under 1983 in the Maine and Thibodeau sentence?
Not at all. I think that Maine versus Thibodeau assumed that the statutes, and correctly assumed, that the statutes involved conferred rights. This contention was not at all.
And there's no contention here that there's any statute, federal statute.
Not at all. Not at all. Yes, the important sense in which the Commerce Clause does not grant rights, and the important sense in which we do not believe petitioner had a right to drive 65-foot vehicles, as we usually employ that term and as the framers or as the drafters of 1983 employed that term, is that Congress could have, I don't think it's likely that they will, but Congress may turn around tomorrow and say, the limit for all country is 55 feet, or they may set up a local option system and restore, if you will, Iowa's authority. They may redress that balance. And in that sense, we do not have a claim of individual rights against government, because a true claim of individual right, in some sense,
Congress did that, and then your opponent say Iowa said, well, we still are going to insist on a shorter limit. We're just going to pay no attention to the federal statute, and they had to sue you under the federal statute. And then could they have a claim under federal law under 1983?
I would not, if I understand your hypothetical, I would not think that a federal statute that simply imposed a length limit.
Say the federal statute said that they shall be allowed to drive trucks at least 60 feet long. And you said, no, in Iowa they got to be no more than 50 feet. And then they sued you to invalidate your statute as under the supremacy clause.
For violation of the federal statute.
And then you would not have jurisdiction under Chapman, but would you not have a 1983 claim?
If this court would then have to construe that statute.
Be a Maine and Thibodeau problem.
That would be a Maine versus Thibodeau problem, a Pennhurst problem of addressing whether Congress intended to confer rights under that statute. And if this court concluded that, and it's not a would not be an implausible suggestion, that then they could be back under 1980. Congress, in many respects, can expand or contract the scope of 1983 with respect to the Maine versus Thibodeau aspect. But it is not, just to sum up that point, a true constitutional right if Congress can simply say, no, you're not going to drive those trucks that length any longer. And I think that generalization will more, although this court may apply a somewhat different standard review to some when a congressional action is challenged in certain areas than with the states. I think that generalization holds across the whole range of what constitutional law casebook authors and so on treat as individual rights.
Why would you say that there would be 1331 jurisdiction?
I think it is a claim arising under the Constitution.
It's a claim that it's a claim to be free from state regulation.
It's an ultra vires claim. It's a claim that the state.
Well, it's a claim that you have a right not to be regulated by the state in this area.
Would not deny that we occasionally, maybe more than occasionally.
Suppose a congressional statute in the. Based on the commerce power, subjects an area to regulation, and the bottom line of it is, and state laws in this area will be foreclosed or preempted.
That certainly gives one a federal claim.
And if the state then threatens to enforce its a statute in that area against a person. He may resort to federal court claiming that he has a right to be free of that state regulation.
That the court should direct the state to continue to do it. There's no question that, as a matter of speech, we occasionally use the term right to, in the sense of any claim that's been vindicated by legal process.
Well,
I wouldn't deny that, but
1983 doesn't then require that the right be created by the Constitution. It just requires it to be secured.
Nothing about our argument, I believe, challenges that proposition. If what I meant to suggest in response to Justice Stevens' question a while ago was that you can go beyond the text of the Constitution where that's appropriate, and that under the Maine versus Thibodeau aspect, what you can look to see what Congress had done. Whether
you wouldn't suggest that you might have a 1983 suit where there's been a congressional occupation of the field by statute and yet not have a 1983 suit when the claim is just based on the Commerce Clause itself?
It would seem to me that a preemption claim without
It always has to be based in part on the Commerce Clause.
The underlying congressional authority, certainly.
Well, sure, and then the supremacy clause.
That's correct. I think unless it's fair to say that Congress intended to create rights, that would not come within 1983, within the language of 1983.
Congress just said that state regulation in this area will be invalid.
That's correct. Perhaps I can give another example. We assume an art lover who commissions a sculptor to build a major project for his front lawn. And along comes the city zoning inspector and says, that is out of conformity with our aesthetic requirements. The person challenging, and they say, you must take it down, you cannot have it there. The person challenging that might have at least two different claims. One would be that the city did not have the authority under state law to zone for aesthetic purposes. They might also have a claim that this constituted a taking of property without due process of law. The latter claim is a claim of individual right. It's a claim that no government can take my property without compensating me for it. The other claim is an ultra vires claim. It's defeasible in the sense that the Iowa legislature could, the next session, turn around and authorize zoning for aesthetic purposes. I think that distinction is basic to our constitutional jurisprudence, despite the fact that the admittedly abstract term right is occasionally used to announce a result, if you will, rather than as a starting point for analysis.
Mr. Shantz, your opponent places a good bit of reliance, as I read his brief, on the North Cross case. You don't cite it. Do you have any comment to make about it?
Petitioner cites North Cross for the proposition that this court required, I believe it was the Sixth Circuit, to state reasons. I do not read the case that way, with all respect. What happened there was that it was an application for fees under Section 718 of the Emergency School Aid Act of 1972, which is worded somewhat similarly to 1988. The Sixth Circuit denied without elaboration. The petitioner sought review by this court. This court held that, yes, and this case fell within Section 718. Attorney's fees were authorized. This petitioner was eligible. They addressed that question, as we're asking this court to address that question, resolved it, and then said, but perhaps the Sixth Circuit was denying fees in the exercise of its discretion. It did not inform us of that, so we will remand for further proceedings where they can express the discretionary reasons for denying fees. So at least in terms of addressing this issue, North Cross would support this court affirming on the basis that the Commerce Clause cases do not are not within 1983. And it also does not.
Cross case also held that this court, and in two other cases prior to that, said that normally under that section you get counsel fees.
That's right.
That's not true in this case.
If you're within 1983, you normally get attorney's fees. But our position is they're not within 1983.
But this didn't involve 1988, the North Cross case.
No, that was a separate fee-shifting case. Unless the court has further questions, I think that concludes my argument. Thank you.
Letter, you have 2 minutes remaining.
The question, which I think has been addressed in several different ways, of whether or not there's a right present, in several cases has been addressed as whether or not the Constitution creates a right. We do not assert that the Constitution creates a right to engage in interstate commerce. What we assert is that there predated and preexisted the Constitution a right to engage in commerce, a subspecies of the right to possess property, or stated in many of the colonial constitutions, to acquire, possess, and protect property, and that the Constitution secured that right. Not that it created it, but it secured it, and the way it secured it was by removing from the states and giving to Congress the power to regulate the right. Mr. Shantz suggested that there could be no right because obviously Congress had the power to take away the ability of my client to use 65-foot twin trailers if it chose to pass a bill. Yes, Congress could do that. The fact that you can pass regulations regulating the right does not mean that the right does not exist. any more than the fact, as was addressed before this Court this morning, that we may put limits on the right of lawyers to speak in advertisements means that there's no right to engage in free speech.
What I understand you to be arguing, you're saying that before the federal Constitution was adopted, there was a right, say, in Massachusetts to go into Connecticut and engage in commerce? And
that's
if Connecticut said we won't let you in?
There was a right to engage in commerce, and further,
across state lines, across
the international
line,
foreign commerce.
That a Massachusetts citizen had a right to engage in commerce in a foreign state?
Subject to regulation, yes. I don't think that that would surprise the Court if you reflect for one moment on the fact that one of the causes of the Revolution were the Navigation Acts, which limited the right of colonials to engage in commerce and were regarded as a grave affront by a colony that, in effect, or by a series of colonies, that relied very heavily on commerce for their livelihood.
But wasn't that one of the reasons for the calling of the Annapolis Convention that led to the Philadelphia Convention? The fact that prior to the Constitution, the states could impose barriers, and many residents felt that it was time to have a constitution that empowered a central government to regulate them.
That's right. That it was time to empower a central government, and in so doing, partially remove the power from the state because the right needed protection.
Wasn't a right until it was put in the Constitution.
It was a natural right and regarded as such by the framers. In fact, it was listed as a specific right in the Articles of Confederation.
Would you say anything that John Locke's text said was a natural right is secured by the Constitution under 1983?
No, Your Honor. But this Court has repeatedly recognized it not only as a right secured by the Constitution, but as a natural right. My reference, of course, is to Justice Marshall in Gibbons v. Ogden, who states...
I didn't say anything about natural rights. I didn't say anything about natural rights, I'm sure.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...